I'm Anna Sale, in for Leonard Lopate today. In February 2012, five members of the group Pussy Riot entered the Cathedral of Christ the Savior in central Moscow. In neon clothing and balaclavas, they performed Punk Prayer, a call to remove Russian President Vladimir Putin from power. Their performance art was quickly shut down, within a minute, in fact, and three of the members of Pussy Riot, Nadia, Kat, and Maria, were later arrested. Their treatment, trial, and detention made them an international cause and global celebrities. Now all three are out of prison as Russia prepares for the upcoming Olympic Games, but they're hardly keeping quiet. In her new book, Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot, Russian-American journalist Masha Gessen tells their story and examines the profound problems confronting Russia today. It's published by Riverhead Books, and I'm so pleased to welcome Masha back to the Leonard Lopate Show. Hello.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Where does this title, Words Will Break Cement, come from?
It comes from Nadia's sort of the mastermind behind Pussy Riot, from Nadia's closing statement in court in Moscow. And she, in fact, was quoting Solzhenitsyn. Hmm. And what she was saying was that she believed that eventually words will break cement.
So Nadia, one of the members of Pussy Riot, is seeing herself in this history of Russian activism and opposition.
Increasingly so. Actually, it's interesting because all of their stories are quite different. And I go through all three stories and all three evolutions in the book, looking at how they came to activism. Maria Alekhina, who is the other Pussy Riot member who served almost the entire 2 years, she very much identified as an activist even before she went to prison. Nadia identified more as a philosopher and an artist. And she, for a while, was actually a reluctant activist, a sort of a political activist. She didn't see herself as that. She, up until last summer when I visited her in prison, she was very much trying to figure out where her identity as a protest artist could fit in with her new experience. And she finally has emerged as a very outspoken political activist.
Oh, interesting. So many people may have heard of Pussy Riot and probably seen pictures, too. But what exactly was the mission when they first started getting together and making noise?
It's a protest art collective, right? So Pussy Riot itself, Pussy Riot as a punk band, is a character created by the protest art collective. So this was a punk band that staged guerrilla performances in various places in Moscow, from fashion shows to a garage roof outside a jail to Red Square, in which they sang and screamed about things that they found objectionable in Putin's Russia, which included human rights abuses, restrictions on freedom of assembly, and unbridled consumerism. So they had sort of this very broad left protest agenda that would seem sort of predictable in the West, and that was completely revolutionary for Russia. They started, they invented themselves before the protest movement started in Russia in 2011, just before. And then they sort of ended up on this large wave of protest, which is when they staged their performance in Red Square and ultimately their performance in the Cathedral of Christ the Savior, which was staged to protest the symbiosis of church and state.
So these are women performing punk activism. And I think of Riot Girls and Bikini Kill. And you note that this is completely unprecedented in Russia. I mean, what did people immediately make of these women showing up in quite colorful, fashionable outfits and neon ski masks?
They were thinking of Riot Girls and Bikini Kill as well. But of course, most people in Russia had never heard of any of that. So it was jarring. And that's, of course, part of its success. When they showed up in their neon balaclavas and their matching or mismatching stockings and dresses in the Cathedral of Christ the Savior, a lot of people, even those who would have been sympathetic to them, thought this was inappropriate, thought this was pushing it too far, which I would argue was the effect that they were going for. How do you get an extremely cynical, extremely tired society to talk about things that are truly important, except by shaking it awake? And that's what they were doing.
Did they know going into the cathedral that day that they were likely going to end up in prison?
Absolutely not. They had talked about prison, but I think what they had in mind was a couple of weeks administrative arrest. They were willing to risk that. They could not imagine that they would be sentenced to 2 years in prison. And they had good reason for not imagining it. They were the first people in Putin's crackdown on protest. They were arrested the day that Putin was reelected, as they claim, to his third term as president of Russia. This was when the crackdown began. And so they became symbols not only of protest, but also of the crackdown. But in the book, I quote at length Maria's letters from prison, which she was incredibly kind to let me read and quote. And you can see her evolution. You can see at one point she writes to her friend, I have figured out sort of how to survive here. Even if I have to spend 6 months or even a year in prison, I think I can do it. It didn't occur to her that she was actually going to get 2 years, not in jail, but in a penal colony.
And we should note that both the women who served 2 years are parents, they're mothers, they've got young children.
They're very young mothers of very young children. So their children are 5 and 6 years old, respectively. So they've been gone for a third of their lives.
You mentioned being able to read Maria's letters from prison, and reading your book in the opening pages, it's quite clear that your access to these women was different than what we've sort of consumed in the global press. You start with a scene where you're following Nadia's family on their way to a trip to prison, and her husband is having to walk out to the car a couple of times so the cameraman can get the shot just right. What was it like as a journalist to watch this sort of, you know, storytelling and mythologizing around them as you're very up close and you know, more intimately involved in their story?
I actually don't think it's an unusual experience for a magazine journalist or certainly a book writer. I've been in that position a lot just because, you know, we all have different jobs to do. Television journalists may take a snapshot and newspaper journalists also take a snapshot. And magazine journalists, which is what I've been when I haven't been writing books, take a really long time and do things like sit around in the car and wait for things to happen, and that's how we get our information. So so I wouldn't say that I felt there was any kind of dissonance. And you know, a lot of the time, the sort of the daily media is part of your longer story. It is part of what gives it depth. It was kind of amazing to watch Peyton, Nadia's husband, who's the only one of the characters in the book whom I'd known a little bit before they were arrested. And my initial feeling about him was that he was so excited that this had happened. It almost looked obscene that he was that it excited him so much that his wife was in prison, and the media attention, he sort of ate it up, and he really knew how to work it. And the more time I spent with him, the more respect I developed for him, and the more I was just in awe of how much he worked. I mean, this is somebody who, for the last 2 years, has been working, I think, 24 hours a day to maintain media attention to the case and to use it to expose things. Like, for example, he invented a way to make the court hearings that they had while they were in prison public by creating a letter-writing campaign among journalists to get access to the courts. So that was sort of an amazing story that I saw unraveling. This is not the kind of thing that you would see unless you were willing to spend months with somebody.
And Nadia and Maria themselves, I mean, you say they didn't anticipate 2 years in a Russian prison. At some point, did they worry about their lives?
Yes, they did. And I think they had very good reason to worry about their lives. I think they should have perhaps worried about their lives more. They had good reason on other occasions as well. But two incidents that stand out are when Maria first arrived in a penal colony in the Urals. She very soon after that, she was surrounded by a group of inmates who were known to be working with the administration, the prison administration. And they threatened her life, and she was reduced to tears, which is not usual for her. She's incredibly strong and resilient, and she was actually felt compelled to ask for protective solitary. Now, protective solitary is exactly the same thing as punitive solitary, except it's called something different. Hmm. So she served for, I think, the first 3 months in the penal colony. She was all alone. She was in solitary. Which by any stretch of the imagination is excessive punishment, even compared to the sentence that she got. But it was very convenient for the penal colony, which I think had her pegged from the beginning. They knew that once they released her into the prison population, she would do what she ended up doing, which is jailhouse lawyering. And she became this incredible activist behind bars.
I'm speaking with Masha Gessen, Russian-American journalist, whose new book is Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. So let's talk about Nadia's activism in prison, because at some point she becomes aware that she's not willing to be quiet, but it's affecting the prisoners around her.
Right. So Maria and Nadia had very different experiences. Maria became sort of a classic jailhouse lawyer very, very quickly. And when she saw that was affecting other inmates, which is the normal way for the prison administration to deal with this, is to crack down, start instituting rules that exist or that are invented to show the other inmates that her protests are making life worse for them rather than better. So that's what happened in Maria's case. She went on hunger strike. This was in the fall, in the spring of last year. She went on hunger strike. She held it for, I think, almost 2 weeks, to the point where she could no longer walk and needed to be hospitalized. And I think when the prison administration realized that she was actually willing to go to the very end with her hunger strike, they caved in. And that was a breaking point for her relationship with the penal colony. From that point on, she basically dictated the rules. She kept writing endless complaints to the relevant authorities and actually affecting real change for the other inmates in the colony. Now, Nadia's situation was a little different. She tried filing a couple of complaints, sort of following Maria's lead. This was in May of last year, and it resulted in an immediate crackdown, and it resulted in the other inmates ostracizing Nadia and attacking Nadia on occasion. And she felt very much at a loss. This was a long crisis for her, because she felt like whatever she did would make things worse for other people and would also put her in extreme danger. So basically, she spent all of last summer thinking up a way to protest. While she was thinking, conditions in her penal colony were getting worse and worse. The workday was growing, so it got to the point where it was 17 hours. That's 17 hours of slave labor, sewing in a factory with outdated sewing equipment. Sleep contracted to about 4 hours a night. Food was rancid and rotten. So anyway, basically she was sleep-deprived, malnourished, and chronically exhausted at all times. And she finally decided that it was intolerable enough to declare a hunger strike. Now, the brilliant thing about a hunger strike is that she would immediately be isolated from other inmates. She would be put in solitary the moment she declared a hunger strike. So she would not be affected by any crackdown, and perhaps a crackdown wouldn't result because it wouldn't be effective to use against her. So that's what she did in September of last year. But the other thing that I think perhaps is even more important that she did was she smuggled an open letter out of prison. She also included it in the book, and it's been published in a couple of places as well, that I think is the most profound and the most searing account of life in Russian prisons since Solzhenitsyn.
What you describe, you're saying penal colony, and what you describe sounds a lot like a Soviet gulag. I mean, should we picture a modern American prison as you're describing this prison? What should we picture?
It is the Soviet gulag. It's not like the Soviet gulag. It's the same colonies and the same culture. And the same slave labor economy. In fact, when I was writing the prison part of the book, I was actually watching Orange is the New Black, in part so that I would have in mind what an American reader would immediately visualize, so I could sort of make corrections as necessary. It looks very different, but most of all, it feels very different. It's an experience of constant humiliation. And just to give you one example, this is something that Nadia has been outspoken about, which is very rare, because most people who have served time in Russian prisons, especially women, are terrified of talking about this because this is so shameful. And these are issues of personal hygiene, as they're euphemistically called. Basically, women are not allowed to wash. There are washrooms in the dormitories, but they're not allowed to use them to wash their bodies. There's also no privacy whatsoever in these washrooms. Once a week, the unit is marched to a common washroom, which is much too small to accommodate it. So there are maybe five sinks and 8,200 women, and all these naked women elbowing each other out of the way to try to get to these faucets, which may or may not have running water on that particular day. And Nadia, when I actually went back to interview her a couple of weeks ago after they were first released, she told me something that I found incredibly telling and sort of one of her rare, truly vulnerable moments when she said that she took to hiding from the guard when they were marched to the common washroom. So humiliating, the experience, that it was better to forego the weekly wash than to submit yourself to being in the common washroom with other women.
And then all of a sudden, Nadia and Maria are no longer in prison, and they emerge, and they are very attractive, photogenic women. What happened? What was their release, and what's been their the reaction within Russia to their release?
Well, their release was timed for the Olympic Games in Sochi. So once Vladimir Putin realized that that the Games were shaping up to be a bit of a public relations disaster, with a number of Western leaders deciding not to attend, he sort of tried to, at the last minute, release a number of high-profile political prisoners, while lower-profile political prisoners stay in prison and are going to prison. I mean, you know, their sentences handed down at the same time as these amnesties went into effect. So Mikhail Khodorkovsky, the former oil tycoon, the Greenpeace activists who were kidnapped in international waters in September, and Nadia and Maria, the Pussy Riot women, were released. So he generously knocked 2 months off of their sentences. By this time, they both felt like they didn't need that kind of charity. They had found their place as activists in the penal colonies. And Maria especially was actually looking for a way to get out of the amnesty and was almost forcibly removed from the penal colony. And yes, I think it's for what they have chosen to be their life's work for now, which is prisoners' rights activism. The image of them coming out of prison, defiant and rather grown up, even though they look shockingly young, and so sort of well-dressed and well-spoken is jarring. I mean, when they talk about what they lived through just a few weeks ago, while being so fashionably dressed and looking like all the other, you know, college students in Moscow, it really does communicate the accurate message that this can happen to anybody in Russia.
Are they identifying as members of Pussy Riot now, that their names are known, that they're not wearing masks?
Pussy Riot is an open membership collective that performs anonymously. So whoever puts on the balaclava is Pussy Riot. The moment a woman takes off her balaclava, she is no longer Pussy Riot. So when they're speaking as Nadia and Maria, they're not Pussy Riot. If they do something as Pussy Riot, they're going to do it anonymously.
I'm speaking with Russian journalist Masha Gessen about Pussy Riot. Her new book is Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot, and the recent release of some of the band's members from prison. The book is published by Riverhead. We'll be back with more about the Russian Olympics and what's to come after the break. I'm Anna Sale, in for Leonard Lopate today, and I'm talking with Russian-American journalist Masha Gessen about Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot, her new book. Russia Today reported this morning that a member of Presidential Human Rights Council has suggested a code of behavior and ethics for activists in Russia in order to separate what they consider attention seekers like Pussy Riot from the true human rights activist. What do you make of that?
Well, first of all, Russia Today is this Ministry of Truth-like institution that Putin created in December, just so we're clear on what we're talking about. I hadn't actually seen that, but it's fairly typical for their pronouncements. It's classic sort of Soviet doublespeak, and or opposite of what you mean speak. And that's exactly what Pussy Riot were actually protesting. That's what I find to be the most fascinating and the most important aspect of their art is sort of their very active search for tools to confront this habit of using words to mean their opposites. So basically, you know, what this particular person is clearly saying is anybody who is caught seeking public attention to, say, human rights abuses in Russia is not a real human rights activist. But anybody who is willing to do it quietly in perhaps negotiations with the Kremlin, which are useless by definition, is a real human rights activist who can, who can have the Kremlin's stamp of approval.
So about this messaging and what's considered allowable activism and what's not, the Russian government has come under fire for the recent passage of laws that outlaw what it calls homosexual propaganda. Has the Kremlin or any other Russian authority cleared up what qualifies as gay propaganda?
Oh, absolutely. Yes, there is a document. The relevant body that's responsible for enforcing this law is the Consumer Authority. And the Consumer Authority commissioned a group of psychologists to write up a document on protecting children, because all of this is done in the name of protecting children, on protecting children from harmful information, including from homosexual propaganda. So it's about 20 pages out of a 109-page document that's devoted to protecting children from so-called homosexual propaganda. Children can be harmed, according to this document. Children won't be harmed by seeing positive images of non-traditional sexual relations. Children will be harmed by any discussion of examples of non-traditional sexual relations. They will be harmed not only by positive, but also by neutral images.
What's a neutral image?
A neutral image, an image while showing which you fail to condemn the non-traditional sexual relationship. And children will also be harmed by seeing negative images of heterosexual relationships, of traditional relationships. So that means that the ban on homosexual propaganda not only bans any portrayal of LGBT people and LGBT families and LGBT relationships, it also bans discussion of domestic abuse. It also bans discussion of single motherhood or childlessness. Or anything. I mean, basically, it's a very broad ban on speech.
You were reporting in Russia as a openly lesbian journalist. Prior to the passage of this law, did you feel comfortable as a family with your kids and your partner?
Absolutely. I mean, I had a dangerous job as a journalist who was outspoken, but so did hundreds of other people. And I never felt that my family would be at risk. I felt like I was taking risks that I felt to be acceptable. What happened with the passage of these laws, and more to the point with the unleashing of this huge campaign of hate on television and in churches and coming from the Kremlin, was that it got very, very personal. So I knew they could go after my family. Well, they said they were going to go after my family. I mean, they said that they wanted to remove children. One of our three children is adopted, so the first kid that they wanted to remove from our family was my oldest son, who's adopted.
How was that communicated to you?
It was communicated to me through an interview by the sponsor of these anti-gay bills that he gave to Komsomolskaya Pravda, which is the largest circulation daily in Russia, in which he said what the Americans want is to adopt Russian orphans and raise them in perverted families like Masha Gessen's, and we need to fight that. So it was communicated fairly directly, yes. One of the self-proclaimed leaders of the so-called Orthodox activist movement has volunteered to adopt my children once they were removed from our family. So it was pretty clear that when they introduced legislation in September that would remove children from same-sex families, that legislation has temporarily been tabled until after the Olympic Games. When they introduced that legislation, they meant us.
Your family has since settled in Harlem in New York. How long did that transition? Tell me about that decision.
Well, the decision was pretty quick because basically, we started talking about it after that interview that Milonov, the sponsor of several of these bills, gave to Komsomolskaya Pravda in March. And in June, when the federal ban on homosexual propaganda was passed, and at the very same time, the parliament also unanimously passed a ban on adoption by same-sex couples or single people from countries where same-sex marriage is legal, we didn't even have to have much of a discussion. It was very clear we just needed to get out. It was a question of when.
Help me understand this from Putin's perspective. You've also written a book about Putin called The Man Without a Face, The Unlikely Rise of Vladimir Putin. Why would he simultaneously be releasing high-profile political prisoners while there's this campaign to crack down on LGBT people within Russia?
Oh, the only anomalous thing in his behavior, and it's only slightly anomalous and perfectly easy to explain, is the release of a number of high-profile prisoners. And we know he did that to try to appease the West in the lead-up to the Olympics. It's cynical, it's transparent, and it's very short-lived. So I think he's going to the extent that he can, some of these people have left the country, but to the extent that he can, he will roll this back as soon as the games are over, and there will be many more arrests, possibly of the same people, once the Olympic Games are over. But other than that, he's perfectly consistent. I think when he looked at the mass protest movement in December of 2011, he saw people that he felt were attacking not only his regime, but Russia itself. So they were the enemy. And who was that enemy? Well, first he said that they were personally inspired by Hillary Clinton. And then, you know, more generally, the West. And basically, I think he sincerely feels that foreign agents, that others are trying to challenge his power, which is essential for Russia to maintain. And nobody personifies the other better than LGBT people. I mean, it is sort of the West's influence embodied in Russia. So that's why we're the first target. We're not going to be the only target. These kinds of xenophobic campaigns based on war rhetoric have to broaden out in order to be effective and in order to keep mobilizing people. But it has proven to be a very effective tool for mobilizing his constituency.
I'm speaking with Russian-American journalist Masha Gessen about her book Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. Haven't you interviewed Putin?
I have not actually interviewed Putin. I wrote my book about him without ever interviewing him. I then did have a personal meeting with him under very bizarre circumstances.
After the book comes out?
After the book came out, it was about 6 months after the book came out. The book was translated into something like 20 languages, but not Russian. And furthermore, after Putin called me, he called me actually personally on my cell phone.
That was a wild moment, I imagine.
This was one of the most bizarre moments of my life. And especially because somebody called me and I was put on hold. And so I was fuming and I screamed at whoever that was who was on the line who had me on hold. And I said, "Don't you want to introduce yourself?" And he said, "Yes, Putin Vladimir Vladimirovich." So the first thing I did was yell at him. But the reason he called me was because I had been editor of a magazine that he loved, a very large popular science magazine in Russia. I had refused to send a reporter to cover Putin's hang gliding adventure with the Siberian cranes. And the publisher, who was terrified of making the wrong step, especially at a magazine that Putin liked, because if he liked it, then he might want to do something about it. And in fact, if Putin likes it, he thinks he owns it. So the publisher, terrified, fired me for this refusal. I tweeted about it. The media in Moscow covered it. Putin apparently heard about it. And because he really liked the magazine, he decided to reinstall me. So he personally called me to ask for a meeting. And it was a little bit like being called, well, actually it was a lot like being called into the principal's office. I was there and my publisher was there. Uh-huh. And he sort of gave us a talking to and then made the publisher offer me my job back.
Was it a cordial meeting? What was the tone in that room?
It was as cordial as any theater of the absurd can be. Ex-publisher was absolutely terrified. And actually, the most painful thing about that meeting was watching him sort of turn all colors of the rainbow and just sweat bullets and buckets. And he was a businessman who had his businesses taken away from him by Putin's people. So he had every reason to be afraid. And here he was trying to protect himself by firing me, and it turned out he had misstepped and he didn't know how to fix it. And Putin is a charmer. That's what he was taught in KGB school. So he was very much trying to charm me what struck me about it was how inept he was at it. And the reason he was inept was because he hadn't been properly briefed. One of the things that no one had told him was that I'd written a book about him.
He didn't know.
He didn't know.
Wow.
And it makes perfect sense that he didn't know, because, again, to know, he would have had to be told, and nobody wants to be the bearer of bad news. So no one told him before this whole thing happened, and after he had called me, it would have been even more scary to tell him, because he had just called.
Gotten your job back.
Well, he just, I didn't accept my job back, but he had just called and had a long telephone conversation with someone who'd written a damning book about him that had been published in 20 languages. So it was a lose-lose proposition for anybody who was briefing him. So he hadn't been told that. He hadn't been told clearly that I was a U.S. citizen, just that was clear from the conversation. The only thing he knew was that I was a journalist, and he clearly surmised that I was Jewish, either because he was told or because of the way I looked. So he made references to that, but that's, the sort of the KGB school of charm involves sort of letting the person know how much you know about them. And that's all he knew.
Did you tell him I wrote a book about you?
I didn't, actually. We were working up to that because we had a long discussion of his nature conservation efforts, and I sort of criticized him, and he was game. And then he had made two points, basically, at the beginning of the conversation, was that he was sincere about nature and that the publisher had gone too far in firing me, because, of course, there should be discipline at a magazine like there is in an army, but he had gone too far. And so I said, and the other thing I'd like to discuss was discipline at a magazine, because, a magazine is not an army. And what I was going to do was quote to him the law on the media, which he is guilty of violating all the time. Because, of course, the Kremlin does appoint editors-in-chief of all sorts of publications. And that's what I wanted to discuss with him. And then I think we probably would have gotten to the book. But the moment I brought that up, he got up and said, okay, I see where this conversation is going. Thank you for coming in.
Wow. What do you hope Western consumers of the Olympic Games, as they're watching that opening ceremony, what do you want them to keep in mind?
I hope that what Western consumers and Eastern consumers of the Olympic Games see when they watch the opening games is how alone Putin is. If they see any Western leaders next to Putin or anywhere there during the opening ceremonies, they will see leaders from the West who are consciously condoning the human rights abuses that Putin is perpetrating on his people, and actually, as of today, also on the people of Ukraine, which has just passed a whole package of laws that that perfectly copy Russian repressive laws on the media and freedom of assembly, and is going into its own crackdown into which it's been pressured by Russia.
Your family immigrated to the U.S. from Soviet Russia. You returned to be a journalist to Russia, and now you are back with your family because you felt like they were in danger. What has that felt like?
Kind of ridiculous. I lived through all of my parents' endless conversations with their friends and with each other about whether it was time to leave, whether they needed to do it to protect their children, whether their friends should leave. And then I heard myself having the same conversations with my partner and with my friends, and trying desperately to talk them into leaving, and suddenly thinking, a month after I made the decision to leave myself, suddenly thinking that anybody who hadn't made that decision was completely insane and irresponsible.
I've been speaking with Russian-American journalist Masha Gessen about Pussy Riot and about her life. Her new book is called Words Will Break Cement, The Passion of Pussy Riot. It's published by Riverhead. Masha Gessen, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you.